Welcome to the first ever Speaking of Mysteries podcast. I'm Nancy Clare, and my partner in this endeavor is Les Klinger. And what we are determined to do is nothing less than bring you the news and views of those who write, act, produce, and direct in the genre of mysteries and thrillers from all over the world. Wherever a mystery is being written, Speaking of Mysteries will not be far behind. And for added spice, we also plan to include true crime as well from time to time. It's our plan to interview major players as well as up-and-comers. We'll preview hot releases in books, movies, and TV, and do our best to introduce you to the new kids in the genre. One of our goals is total interactivity with our listeners. We'll take questions, conduct Twitter views on our website with characters, and roam the floors of major conventions, such as
BoucherCon, the LA Times Festival of Books.
And that's less, just in case you want to know. And I want to go back to Bloody Scotland and Stirling, Scotland, but that's a whole other thing. And we will capture all the moments for those who can't be there. Why are we doing this? In my case, I'm the former editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times Magazine and one of the co-founders of the iPad magazine, Noir Magazine. When I was at the LA Times Magazine, we did an annual issue of mysteries, and as much as I loved doing all the issues, nothing was more fun than asking Michael Connelly to interview Joseph Wamba or ask any number of writers to write it in their characters' voices about their guns, to do a photographic tableau of any number of, you know, integrate fashion into mysteries. It was just, you know, I'm a fan, and we are fans, and we want to know. So we just assume our fellow fans are just as curious. So to get your free weekly download of mystery news, visit our website, speakingofmysteries.com, and subscribe to the podcast. And then sit back and enjoy catching up with the stars of your favorite genre at your convenience on a weekly basis. Tell your fellow mystery lovers about us, and like us on Facebook. And now I'd like to introduce Les Klinger.
Well, so my beginning in the mystery world was way back in the days when I was in law school, and I got hooked on the Sherlock Holmes stories. And reading Holmes led me to want to read more of the classics. So at that point, I branched out to Dorothy Sayers, Lord Peter Simon's mysteries, and Lord Peter Wimsey mysteries, and later the Dashiell Hammetts and the Raymond Chandlers and so on. And then as I became a writer myself in my old age, when I wrote the new annotated Sherlock Holmes, I became involved with the Mystery Writers of America, and eventually served as the chapter president of the Southern California chapter. And in that role, I got to meet a lot of writers, and it was really a joy to discover how open and collegial they were and willing to share their life experiences, their writing career experiences, their mistakes, their successes, support and network with other writers. And that's part of what we hope to do on this show, is to expand that experience to let it be available to other people.
I've always found it really interesting, and I've asked the question a number of times of writers. They write about such dire things and such mean people, and yet to a person, they are always so nice and so giving and so funny. It's maybe because that's the you know, where they work, they don't bring it out of where they work.
They're also very supportive of other writers. I mean, one of the great things to find out about the community is that there's a sense, and several writers have expressed this publicly, there's a sense that your success doesn't mean that they fail. In fact, your success can lead to more success for them. We're all here about building the genre and bringing the news and pleasures of the genre to more people so that it will succeed.
And interestingly, it is a genre that is not age specific. More and more young writers are coming into the field. I mean, you know, Lindsay Fay, who you know, who wrote a Sherlock mystery, Shadow and Dust, is 12. I joke with her. I think she's over 30 now. She might be 31 or 32.
I think she's 32 now.
Roger Hobbs, who was nominated for an Edgar this year, and someone that we hope to speak to, is, I believe, 28 years old. And so it's a genre that's appealing to younger writers as well as older writers, and appeals to younger readers as well as older readers. There's something for everyone in the mystery thriller genre.
Absolutely, and we hope to include YA writers and juvenile mystery writers too, as we support the genre here generally. One of the things that we're going to try and do as well, upcoming at the 1st of May, are the Edgar Awards. The Edgars are the Oscars of the mystery world. And we're going to try and have a selection of some of the nominees talk to us on the show about what the award nomination means to them and what it means to the community. This has always been about trying to lift the genre and trying to make it so that the slogan of the Mystery Writers of America has always been, crime does not pay enough. But it's not about the money. It's about bringing this to a broader audience.
It's about the recognition.
Eventually will bring the money. Yeah. Yes, the money is good.
But even if the money isn't good, I mean, it seems to me that everybody's writing a mystery. Even literary writers, winners of the Man Booker Prize, like John Banville, who writes as Benjamin Black, are writing mysteries. Everybody wants to write a mystery. It's a fun genre to write in, from what I understand from writers, and it's a place where you can have control of a universe. And some writers just do an amazing job. And I think of John Banville, and I think of the Man Booker Prize, and an interesting panel I listened to in Scotland at the first ever Bloody Scotland in Stirling. And they had Ian Rankin and a number of other writers talk about why the more prestigious awards don't recognize mystery writers, and I'm hard pressed to understand why. But as Les said, you know, crime doesn't pay enough, and mystery writers deserve recognition, and also people buy mysteries, and Craig Robertson, who another Scottish mystery writer, said to me once, he goes, we do this for a living. And I think that was a really sort of an important thing to say. And close to 60% of the books that are sold are fiction, are mysteries and thrillers.
And then, you know, some of the genres go in cycles too. Right now, for example, we're seeing comic books dominating the movie industry. There was a time when mysteries dominated the movie industry. They were the hot properties. They were the books that were being made into film. So some of these things go in cycles, and just to make the cycles even more interesting, some of the mystery writers are writing for comic books now.
Graphic novels. But mysteries are finding their way onto the small screen. And I think more and more Michael Connelly's character, Harry Bosch, and there's a very interesting, I'd love to get him on the show to talk about the backstory of regaining the rights to his character. But the pilot for that has just been put out on Amazon. With the expansion of Netflix and Amazon and basic cable, you're seeing more and more mystery and thriller content coming. You've got The Americans, The Following, Justified, based on a short story by Elmore Leonard, even the sort of the stalwarts of broadcast television, CSI, Law and Order.
Right.
People love it.
Well, one of the things that's happened is that television has become a medium that allows writers to tell longer stories. Once upon a time, television was all half-hour or hour-long stories. Your mystery had to be finished and done, wrapped up at the end of the hour. Movies were the primary outlet for longer stories, but even there, you had 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours, and that's it. Now television has evolved to the point where you can tell a story that's 12 hours or even longer, multiple seasons long, a show like The Wire, or The Bridge, The Killing, these wonderful, rich, complex stories that could never be done as film because they don't have the time.
And it's and with the ability to have content on demand, you can binge watch, you can go back. For anyone who might not have subscribed to HBO 5 years ago, you can go back and watch The Wire, maybe my all-time favorite. Breaking Bad.
Veronica Mars.
Veronica Mars, which is now oddly going to be a movie that's being released in the middle of March. But it's a wonderful, rich genre that's full of, there's something for everybody. But I think I said that already.
Well, so we're looking forward to hearing from you as well about who you'd like to have appear on the show, who your favorites are. We're going to be traveling too. We are based in Southern California, but with the wonders of the electronic age, we expect to be talking to writers all over the world, virtually and in person occasionally.
So we look forward to announcing our first interviews on our website. Please let us know, and thank you. I think it's fitting that one of the first interviews I do is with Mr. Klinger, my partner, who is a noted Sherlockian, a member in good standing of the Baker Street Irregulars, and the man who freed Sherlock Holmes.
Well, thanks, Nancy, for the credit for that. It wasn't really me, it was Congress. But so the case has gotten a lot of press, and let me try and put it into context. The case is Klinger versus Conan Doyle Estate Limited, a decision of the Northern District of Illinois that came out basically the day after Christmas, Boxing Day last year, 2013. In 2011, Laurie King and I put together an anthology called A Study in Sherlock. It was published by Random House. It was an anthology of new stories written by major mystery writers inspired by the Sherlock Holmes stories. In the course of doing that, the books had already been printed, the Random House was ready to go. The Conan Doyle Estate Limited, which is a company owned by some grandnieces and grandnephews of Conan Doyle, and it owns the copyrights that remain in the United States, contacted Random House and said, well, you need a license from us to publish your book of new stories about Sherlock Holmes. Laurie and I said, that's nonsense. We've talked to our lawyers, and we don't think that they can prevent us from writing new material. Random House said, well, you know, it costs too much to fight about this. We're going to pay for a license. And that was the end of that. 2 years later, Laurie and I decided, this is now actually in the fall of 2012, we conceived the idea of doing a second volume. We decided to take it to a different publisher. Random House is not ecstatic about anthologies. We shopped the book. There was a bidding war for the anthology. It was going to be the same idea, a collection of stories by major writers not normally associated with Sherlock Holmes, writing stories inspired by the Sherlock Holmes canon, called In the Company of Sherlock Holmes. So we eventually sold the book to Pegasus, and we were in the process of finishing the contract when the Conan Doyle Estate Limited folks contacted Pegasus and said, oh, Klinger and King obviously forgot to tell you that you need to get a license in order to publish this book. The publisher turned to us and said, what do we do? And we said, well, we don't think you need a license. It's our responsibility. Let's go ahead. Publisher said, fine. The next thing that happened, however, was communication from the Conan Doyle Estate Company that said, if you go forward with the book, we're going to block sales of it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the other major distributors. This then frightened off Pegasus, and they said, we can't move ahead with this book. If we can't sell it, what are we going to do? You need to clean this up. So Lori and I talked about it, and we decided to file a lawsuit against the estate. We filed what's called an action for declaratory relief. We weren't suing for damages. We were asking a court to decide that we had the right to proceed without obtaining a license from the estate. Now, in order to understand the case, you need to look at the very strange picture of copyrights of the Sherlock Holmes stories. In every country in the world other than the United States, all of the stories are in what's called the public domain. What that means is they are not subject to copyright protection, and anyone outside the United States can publish one of the original Sherlock Holmes stories without the permission of the estate. And therefore, they can also make up new stories about the characters of Holmes and Watson. There are no separate copyrights for characters. The copyrights arise for the characters out of the protection of the original material. The United States is more complicated. Because of the Bono Act that passed Congress in 2003, some of the Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes stories remain in copyright, 10 of them, remain in copyright. The last one passes into the public domain after 2022. It's 95 years after publication. The first one protected was published in 1923, and the last one protected was published in 1927. So between the years 2018 and 2022, the last 10 stories will be slipping into the public domain. But the estate contends that because any of the stories remain in copyright, they have the right to control the licensing of the use of the character, even though you're not using the stories themselves. That's what we challenged. We said that case law that's already been decided makes it clear that if the predominant characteristics of the character are in public domain material, you don't have to wait till every story slips into the public domain.
And the court ruled in your favor. But so let me ask you a question. The shows like Elementary and Robert Downey Jr.'s movies, did they get a license from the estate?
They did, and I understand that Public Broadcasting System got a license to exhibit the BBC Sherlock series here as well, even though, of course, those shows were produced in England. There's an economic weapon here at play, and it's what I really was angry about in this case, was how the economic position of the estate has made them able to, I will use the word bully, people into obtaining licenses when in fact the law doesn't require them to get a license. If you're making a major motion picture with a budget of $100 million, and these numbers are not accurate, by the way, I'm just going to, they're for illustration, and the estate says we want a license fee of $100,000 to make you feel comfortable that you have the rights and that we're not going to go to court and seek a temporary restraining order on opening day of the film. If you're Warner Brothers, you say, sure, that's chump change. That's a tiny fraction of the budget. Let's pay the license fee and buy certainty. The same applies to CBS TV and the same applied to PBS. The problem that I was having was that they were doing the same thing to, I'm sorry to sound pejorative, but to little creators. I heard a story, for example, about a man who had written his own Sherlock Holmes novel. He had self-published it. He put it up on Amazon. And mysteriously, a few days after he'd uploaded it to their self-publishing program, it disappeared. He contacted Amazon to find out what had happened. Amazon said, well, the estate told us you didn't have a license, so we took it down. He paid $100, he got a license, and lo and behold, it reappeared on Amazon.
So it's a way of holding the characters hostage.
Yes.
And Did your fellow writers think of this as a rather quixotic endeavor on the part of you and Ms. King?
Absolutely. I say to my clients about this all the time. I say, I apologize. I say, lawyers should know better than to bring lawsuits on principle. There's no question that it would have been far, far, far cheaper for us to have simply paid a license fee to the estate. But that wouldn't have solved the problem. That would have made it okay for Laurie and Les to publish this book, but it would have left them out there continuing to be sort of the equivalent of the patent trolls. There's actually a name for what's going on here. A scholar coined the phrase a few years ago, copy fraud. This is claiming copyrights when you don't have them, but because of your economic position, you're able to block the use of the so-called copyrighted material. This happens all the time. For example, take a look the next time you're at a museum, an art museum, and you see a postcard that they've put in their gift shop for one of the paintings that they have. Take a look at a postcard, for example, of a Van Gogh painting. It's not copyrightable in the United States. Nonetheless, the museum will claim a copyright because they can, and nobody challenges them. This is not limited to the Conan Doyle estate. They're not the only people taking advantage of this. One of the areas that's been very controversial is the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate and John Carter and Tarzan, both of which characters are in similar situations of having some stories in the public domain and some not. There will be many people unhappy with this court case. There will be many people happy with this court case.
So you not only liberated Sherlock Holmes and John Watson from copyright limbo, you also liberated Tarzan, John Carter,
perhaps,
and, you know, numerous others. And I would imagine that there are people in the same situation as the Conan Doyle estate who are not terribly happy because it's a source of income.
Right. Now, I want to be clear here. We did not seek and did not make new law. This rule actually goes back to a case of Fred, I believe it was Fred Silverman, involved with the Amos and Andy characters. There was a production of an Amos and Andy television series, and the question was whether the characters were in the public domain or not for new stories about those characters. Very similar situation. Some of the radio episodes had lapsed into the public domain. And the court said, yes, you can use the characters. The characters are not protected if the predominant characteristics of the characters are in public domain material. And it's that case that the court in our case relied upon. It's the estate that's asking the court, and now they've appealed to the Seventh Circuit. It's the estate that's asking the court to make new law. They have a theory that, which to me is absurd, but a theory that until Conan Doyle laid down his pen in 1927 with the last of the Sherlock Holmes stories, the character was not complete. And therefore, it's still protected. Now, to me, that goes way too far because it means that the character prior to that was not complete and was not subject to protection. Does that mean that the earlier stories are not copyrightable?
Well, so what you're saying is people like Laurie King, with her Mary Russell series, she received a license.
She did not.
She actually did not.
Interestingly, Laurie started publishing her series back in the 80s, and she convinced the publishers that they didn't need a license, and she was never challenged.
Interesting. So, did you bring that into the court case?
No. We didn't because Random House was very concerned that the estate would extract a retribution here and try and block the sales of the Mary Russell series, which is a hugely successful series.
It's fascinating. So, So from here on in, if I wanted to write a story for an anthology, or if I wanted to write another Sherlock Holmes story, I could do it, at least until the appeal. Unless the appeal is up. How should I put that?
The appeal is going to be decided probably sometime this summer. And at that point in time, it'll be over. In the meantime, people can rely on the district court decision. But, I mean, it's already happening. Here, for example, I'm holding in my hand, you can see it.
Yes, I see.
Is the latest issue of Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, published in February. And its lead story is The Red-Headed League by Terence Faherty. Now, this is a story that retells the Conan Doyle story, The Red-Headed League, in his own way, clearly uses the character of Sherlock Holmes. It's a tribute to Sherlock Holmes. And there's no indication here that he obtained a license from the Conan Doyle estate, and I'm quite sure that he did not. So publishers understand that this is an aggressive position by the estate, and depending on the context, they may be ready to go ahead without a license. We're moving ahead, by the way, at this point with our book with Pegasus. Pegasus is comfortable enough, based on the district court opinion, to proceed with publication, and the book will be out in October. But we won't have a definitive answer until the appeal's done. But in the meantime, I think the court's right, and I don't see the appellate court overturning the case. I don't see them making new law in this area. It's possible, but I think it's very unlikely.
Was the case argued in open court, or was it all done through depositions and
actually,
filings?
Very interesting. The Conan Doyle estate apparently decided that they would see how far they could get by not appearing in the case. So we filed our pleadings, and the estate defaulted, meaning they did not file a response to our pleadings. Now, at that point, we could have taken a default judgment, sort of like, you know, when you have a sports
game. Like small claims.
Well, it's like a sports game, and the other team doesn't show up. You win. But we knew that if we did that in this context, it would only be a win for this particular book in the company of Sherlock Holmes for Les Klinger. It would not be a win for other creators or other books. And so we filed a motion for summary judgment asking the court that even though the estate hadn't responded, we wanted the court to issue a ruling, as lawyers say, on the merits, meaning a reasoned decision of why we were right. At that point, the estate finally realized that they had to do something. They couldn't just let it slide. So they filed responses. There were no trials. There was no depositions. This was all what we call stipulated facts. So it was all done with briefing. When it goes to the Court of Appeals now, there is likely to be oral argument, but that's it. There's no depositions. We did have declarations from expert witnesses. We had declarations from Peter Blau, a longtime renowned Sherlockian, Steve Rothman, the editor of the Baker Street Journal. They had expert witnesses on their side. My lawyer said to me, unfortunately, the best expert witness we would have liked to use less was you, but we can't do that. So that's how the case proceeded.
And it's interesting. It's interesting to think that these characters that are prevalent and have been in films and television and radio shows are property.
Clearly they are. And, you know, this is not an anti-copyright case. This is not a case. Lori and I are not believers that information deserves to be free. This is not WikiLeaks. We support copyrights. When I prepared my new annotated Sherlock Holmes, I paid a very substantial license fee to the Conan Doyle estate for the right to publish the 10 stories that remain in copyright. We honor and respect copyrights. My objection here was that the estate wasn't following the rules. They simply were ignoring the rules. The stories that remain in copyright did not give them permission to demand license fees for the use of the characters. By the way, I should say, anyone who wants to know a good deal more about the case, we did create a website, free-sherlock.com, and it's got all of the pleadings, all of the briefs, many of the press pieces that appeared. There were a lot of op-ed pieces. There was a lot of press coverage, not as good as this podcast coverage, of course. But
and, of course, we'll have a link to that website on our website, speaking of mysteries.com. But I also wanted to ask a question about, so now we're going to get to see In the Company of Sherlock Holmes with the liberated Sherlock Holmes. Can you tell us any of the writers who contributed stories?
Sure. We are thrilled at the contributors. I know I'm going to forget some if I rattle them all off, but I'll give it a shot. We have Michael Connelly, Sarah Paretsky, Jeff Deaver from the Mystery World. We have some exciting writers, Denise Hamilton. We also have some writers from outside the Mystery World. Lev Grossman, Cornelia Funke, Michael Scott, the well-known Irish fantasy writer. Larry Niven, Gayan Wilson, some others in the thriller world, Andrew Grant, Laura Caldwell, Harlan Ellison has promised to write a story for us. It's going to be an amazing collection with a disparate representation. Oh, and I should mention John Repian and Leah Moore, wonderful comic book writers, have written a graphic story for us that is terrific. We're very excited about it and can't wait to bring it out.
And in light of the fact that some writers may have been maybe missing from this list, we'll also have a list on the website of all the writers that are contributing to In the Company of Sherlock Holmes. Well, thank you for explaining that to me. You know, Les understands all this. He's a lawyer. I'm not.
Not an intellectual property lawyer, but I've learned a lot.
But he plays one on TV, or he plays one on a podcast. Anyway, there it is in a nutshell. Les Klinger and Laurie King, Liberators of Sherlock Holmes. I would just keep the title.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.